funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you wish you knew about the people closest to you, and what aspects of their lives might have something to tell us all? Since 2004, the much-loved 2003, the much-loved StoryCorps project has invited Americans to go on the record with loved ones, talking about the people, events, and ideas that have touched them. The focus of the project has always been on ordinary people rather than luminaries and celebrities. But as we've heard in the hundreds of specially edited selections shared on NPR over the years, the conversations and what they reveal are often quite extraordinary. David Isay is founder of StoryCorps and author of the new book Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. The StoryCorps mobile booth will be parked at the AT&T Performing Arts Center starting November 20th to record in this area for a month. Dave, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be back.
So you're sending this mobile booth to Dallas in 10 days. It's actually like a converted Airstream trailer. Is that right?
That's right. Yep. It's been all across the country. I think it's been to Dallas before. And we're excited to come back. We will, I think we're about to hit, and maybe we'll do this in Dallas, our 100,000th participant. And I can think of no place we'd rather do that than in Dallas.
Well, we will be happy to set the record for you if we yeah. can. Things I know are filled up. There is a wait list, though, for people who might not have made a reservation. Is that right?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, I've been on the road for a while, and I've been talking a little bit about StoryCorps. And, you know, one of the things about StoryCorps is when we started this 11 years ago, you know, nobody actually – we started here in New York City, and it was this crazy idea, this booth in Grand Central Terminal, and nobody actually wanted to participate. So we would have people like – we had one woman who did 200 interviews, like everyone she ever met. She'd ride the subway and, like, pull people off the subway and bring them in. And then in the, you know, intervening time, people have started to understand what we're doing. And, yeah, when we open up in a city, we sell out immediately and have long, long waiting lists.
Have patterns emerged? Are you now – are there a number of things that people consistently want to talk about in these interviews?
Yes. And it's not – the pattern emerged on the first day of StoryCorps and has continued until, you know, today. And I think, you know, people talk about what's most important in their lives. And it's – you know, folks know that, you know, the core of what we do, the radio stories are like a wonderful byproduct of the public service we offer, which is – giving two people, usually people who know each other well, care about each other, the chance to sit in a room, in this case in an Airstream trailer, with a trained facilitator and talk about what's most important in their lives. And, you know, many of these – you know, a lot of people think of it as, if I had 40 minutes left to live, what would I say to this person who means so much to me? And you well know the power of the microphone to give you the license to talk about things you don't normally get to talk about. So the, you know, what's talked about in the booth every day are kind of the great themes of human existence. It's about love. It's about, you know, losing people. You know, people ask, people prepare before they come to the booth, and we have like the 10 most popular questions, and they're wisdom questions. I mean, it's very much a kind of a transmission of wisdom project. And people talk about how they want to be remembered and their, you know, the most important lessons they've learned in life and that sort of stuff. So and all this stuff, of course, goes to the Library of Congress so that folks' great, 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 great grandkids can get to know them through their voice and story. So, yeah. So, you know, the theme is it's intense.
Is there a warm up period? Like, does it take 10 minutes in to get people to really be comfortable?
Yeah. No, I mean, people start by saying, you know, there's a little – they each say who they are and who they're talking to and what the date is. And the facilitators who call their job, you know, bearing witness to these interviews and are essentially, when I talk about wisdom, you know, they're traveling the country collecting the wisdom of humanity. They'll say to the people who are the participants in the booth, like, ask that question you've always wanted to ask right when you sit down, because those 40 minutes go by so fast. So the interviews start, you know, start – have intense, you know, and go that way for the entire 40 minutes. And then the stories we play, I think, on NPR, on KERA, and everywhere else around the country, I hope, you know, help us, you know, to me, these are the real American stories. We're surrounded by so much kind of nonsense and everywhere we look. And people who come to StoryCorps, no one comes to get rich. No one comes to get famous. It's kind of the opposite of reality TV. It's just this act of kind of generosity and love, saying to someone who matters to you, like, who are you? What have you learned in life? And letting them know that their lives matter and they won't be forgotten. And hopefully when people hear these stories, they'll recognize a little bit of themselves in the person whose story they hear on Friday on KERA and recognize all those things that are so core to the values of, you know, of public radio and the truth that, you know, when you get down to it, there's really a lot more that we share in common than divides us. And maybe if we spent more time listening to each other and less time screaming at each other, we'd be a better and stronger country.
Amen. Let's listen to one that's not too old that I particularly like. This is Will Smith and his daughter Olivia. He was 27 when he enrolled as a freshman at Bowdoin College in Maine, but unlike most of his other classmates, he was older. He also had his infant daughter along. Now she's a teenager, and the two of them sat down to have a conversation shortly after Will was diagnosed with colon cancer.
I had to take you in with me at work sometimes and hide you in the closet. I think I lost something like 27 pounds just from stress and not eating because I didn't have enough for both of us. My basketball teammates were my first babysitters. I just remember coming from class and there were four giant guys and there was this 18-month-old who was tearing up the room.
Were you ever embarrassed bringing me to class or just having me in general?
I felt a little awkward, but never embarrassed. My graduation day from Bowdoin is a day I'll never forget. You know, all of my classmates, they stood up and gave me the only standing ovation.
I remember walking up with you and having my head in your shoulder.
Yeah, the dean called both of our names as he presented us with the diploma.
So technically, I already graduated from college. So.
Nice try. That degree only has my name on it, so you still got to go.
That is Will Smith and his daughter Olivia, recorded by StoryCorps in Sheffield, Massachusetts. You know, one thing I really like about that piece, Dave, is that sometimes you listen to StoryCorps and you have the sense that two people are saying something to each other that they've never said before. And other times there's a sort of beauty in maybe hearing again, the stories that people have told one another for years.
Absolutely. You know, and I think what we're trying to do is, kind of distill these stories down into like a little bit of poetry every week. And what I hope happens is it kind of shakes you on the shoulder when you hear this in the midst of all the news and, you know, often bad news, that it kind of shakes you on the shoulder and reminds you like this is what's important. And this is who we are, you know, as Americans.
Any poet will tell you that the greatest work takes a lot of editing.
Yes.
And I was astonished. We found some live tweeting about StoryCorps that happened,
yes.
I think, on Friday.
Yesterday,
I'm sorry. And
yeah, it was in Chicago.
How many cuts do you have for a 3-minute piece that appears on
radio?
I
was doing a session with the lead producer of StoryCorps, and I think there's – you know, these are 40-minute interviews. It's one out of every 300 interviews, something like that, that gets on the air. And I should say that each interview to us is equally important. And we look at it as kind of a, you know, we look at our bond with our participants as a sacred bond. And we hope it's an important moment in people's lives to participate. But some stories have this kind of universal quality that makes them appropriate to share with a wider audience. And so we'll edit 3 minutes out of every one, you know, every several hundred stories. And the production team does hundreds of edits in a 3-minute cut. And it's mostly just for pacing and taking out ums and, you know, kind of getting it down, again, distilling it to the essence of what that story is. And then, of course, we play the stories back before they're broadcast to the participants and make sure they're comfortable with them. And, you know, we've done 600 weeks in a row on Morning Edition, and everyone's been, you know, I think felt that we've accurately, like, kind of painted this portrait of who they are. And in these 3 minutes, kind of, you know, distilled the essence of their story. And they're all also fact-checked, heavily fact-checked to kind of New Yorker magazine standards. So every line is checked one way or another. And that's what you hear on the radio.
Has anybody lobbied for, like, StoryCorps, the director's cut? You know, maybe a 15-minute version of these where longer
someday
stories
they'll
get
come.
Told? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and someday we'll do something more like that. But, you know, again, the the 3 minutes that we get on Morning Edition is heard by, you know, millions and millions and millions of people. And it does feel like kind of the right format for us. But we do things like put stories together on a theme. We have a bunch of military stories that we've been doing over the last couple of years with post 9/11 vets. And if folks go to our website tomorrow for Veterans Day, there'll be an hour long special there that you can hear that compiles, you know, many of these stories. So there's lots of different stuff to do. And as the years go on, you're going to hear different kind of ways that we work with the StoryCorps material. We also do animations of some of these stories. So we're doing everything we can to just kind of push these out by any means necessary and, you know, expose people to these to the stories of, as you said, everyday irregular people that are, you know, in anything but regular.
Let's listen here to Sergeant Ryan Sharp and his father, Kirk Sharp. Sergeant Ryan Sharp served two tours of duty in Iraq with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. In 2008, when he returned to the States after his last tour, things were not the same.
Do you remember any of our conversations while you were considering ending your own life?
No, I don't remember any of the conversations. It's like I blacked out. I came home and things were different.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember me and my sister Stacy were all at the pool. And I don't remember exactly what happened, but I remember I had my pistol up to my temple. My finger was on the trigger. And then my sister said, "What are you doing?" I think it was after that I ran into the woods. I ran off with my gun, and apparently I wanted to shoot myself in the woods.
I wish I would have known more, then we could have gotten you help sooner. I'd seen a completely different Ryan, and I didn't understand how to deal with it. And at that point, you had no idea that you had a traumatic brain injury?
No idea at all. Until when I reconnected with Justin. I had been deployed with this man, and he was telling me how he was on permanent disability through the VA. And I was like, "Oh my God, man, what happened?" And he says, "I have a TBI. And I go, "When did you get that?" And he goes, "You were there." And I go, "What are you talking about?" At that point, things just started coming back. And the first thing that came to me was the explosion in my head, the pain of it. And then the next thing I remember is my team leader had grabbed me by my vest and was shaking me, asking, you know, "Sharp, Sharp, Sharp."
This event occurred how many years prior to the diagnosis?
Almost 10 years.
How did that make you feel after finally being diagnosed?
I was angry because the entire time I thought these issues that I was having were fixable. I didn't trust myself, and I still don't to an extent. But the things that are wrong with me are an injury, and I can't necessarily fix them, but I can learn to deal with them.
That is Sergeant Ryan Sharp speaking with his father, Kirk Sharp. That was recorded in Lincoln, Nebraska. Some of these, Dave, I think become more, they resonate when we listen to them, and then the more we think about them. This one in particular sort of stuck with me throughout the day that I first heard it last week.
Yeah, it was on Saturday, and I thank you for playing it because I've been on the road and I didn't get a chance to hear it. And I asked your producer if we might play it so we could listen together. Yeah. Yeah, they stick with you because I think, you know, I think that, that, you know, first of all, this is a really disturbing story. And a lot of these military stories are upsetting. But I think we have an obligation to listen to these, to hear what our service men and women have gone through in our name in order to understand the obstacles they face when they return home. It creates an emotional marker, and it's when you feel something, you remember it, and that's why it sticks with you.
David Isay is my guest. He is founder of StoryCorps, author of the new book Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. The mobile booth will be at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas starting November 20th. Welcome back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with StoryCorps founder David Isay. He's got a new book out called Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. The StoryCorps mobile booth will be parked at the AT&T Performing Arts Center starting November 20th to record in North Texas for a month. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So your latest printed collection of stories is centered around themes of love and gratitude. And so often in these, even when it would appear that the interview's about something else, it seems that they conclude with this expression of affection and also kind of recognition of what the other person has meant to them.
Absolutely. And, you know, the book is actually – it came out last year. It's just out in paperback. And it's really – it's a book of thanks from StoryCorps. And what happens frequently in StoryCorps interviews is that at the end of an interview, the person who's doing the – asking the questions will kind of turn the table on the person they're talking to and tell them what they've meant to them. Again, using this kind of formal setting of the StoryCorps booth and the facilitator and the interview going to the Library of Congress – to say the things that, you know, you think your, you know, whoever it is, your grandparent, your friend knows, but that, you know, that you don't, you know, always say over the course of day-to-day conversation. So at the end of an interview, often people will kind of say what this person, and because, as we said, like when you were talking about with the booth in Dallas, that it's hard to get an interview. People usually bring someone who's very, very, very important in their lives to honor them by listening to them. So at the end of the interviews, often there's this kind of exchange of people talking about what they've meant to each other.
Do you ever have to kick people out of the booth? In other words, it's they want to continue.
You know, it's funny. The people who you have to kind of kick out of – the answer is yes. The 40 minutes goes by very quickly. Mm-hmm. But the people that you really have to kick out of the booth are the ones who, like, never wanted to go in the first place. Mm. You know, the ones who are like, I don't have a story to tell. Why do you want to listen to me? And then you sit them down and, man.
We have an email here from Wanda who says, I know in the past you could have a recording system sent to you so that an interview could be done without the booth. Is that still available?
It is. And we're gonna create soon enough a system so that it's easy for people to do it off mobile devices. That turned out we're a public service. People come to StoryCorps, they participate. It doesn't cost anything. Half of our slots are actually held for people who might not have heard of us through the newspapers or public radio. So we work with hundreds of nonprofits across the country each year, as we will in Dallas, so that whether it's kids who are in the juvenile justice system or homeless people or whoever it is gets a chance to come to this booth. And as I said earlier, to be listened to and recognize that their life matters, that it's important enough to be in the Library of Congress and have this experience. So half the slots go to them. We still have some kits that we'll send out in an absolute emergency, but it's actually incredibly expensive to even just Federal Express them around. So we're figuring out kind of new methods to do this digitally that are a little bit easier. And we have a program that's growing now where we're putting StoryCorps in libraries and kind of having more and more StoryCorps outposts out there. But even if you don't have a kit, the important thing is to and if you can't get a slot, the important thing is to have these conversations. And, you know, we all have the means to do it now. You know, with a cell phone, you can record. And we'll have an app at some point before too long that makes it much easier to do this. But sit down with a loved one in a quiet place and, you know, and talk to them and ask them these questions.
So there are moments of warmth and joy in StoryCorps. There are also discussions of things that aren't so easy to talk about. And I want to listen here to this discussion between two brothers, Michael and Brian Wilmuth, 8 siblings total. They grew up in this very strict religious household. Over the years, all of the siblings have become estranged from their parents. It turns out Brian, who is gay, was the first to get kicked out.
Dad found a love letter from a guy in my box of things, and he read this letter and lost it. He took me for a ride and dropped me off in the middle of the night with a $5 bill. That's sort of all I remember, sleeping outside in the country that night. And I really missed my brothers and sisters when I left home. I remember hearing that if you guys talked to me, if I'd called the house, that you'd get a beating because Dad didn't want you to catch gay. And you guys believed that.
Granted, it was a fear-based belief.
Of course, but, you know, it was still something I had to try to fix. And so as each of you guys moved out or got kicked out of the house.
Or ran away
in your case. I would make an effort to try to contact you guys and be a big brother again. And that's when we started coming back together, you know, as brothers and sisters. Brian, Pam, Chris, Mike, Jude, Amy, Josh, and Luke Henry. Now, Luke Henry, I didn't even know because he wasn't born until I was like 19 or 20. And I got a call and the voice on the other end said, Brian, this is your little brother, Luke. By this time, you know, he was estranged from mom and dad and he wanted to go to University of Dallas. So I took my savings, which wasn't a lot, and I bought one one-way ticket and one round-trip ticket to Dallas. Now, mind you, this is a Catholic school, and I'm the big gay brother. I'm running around getting him set up for his dorm room, and we go through this whole weekend, and at the end, I gave Luke a hug and a kiss and told him how much I loved him, and he started walking away. I was just watching after him like, wow, I really finally got to be a big brother. And at that moment, he turned around and mouthed, I love you. It was the most beautiful moment I had ever experienced. And I called you from the hotel, sobbing. Do you remember this?
Yeah. You brought 8 siblings that were so far apart to be as close as we all became.
I just want you to know how much you mean to me, that you've loved me like this. And for that, I will be forever grateful. It is what I built the foundation of the rest of my life on.
And let me say that 40 minutes is not enough. I could do this for 4 hours, 4 days, 4 months. You're a good man.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Brothers Brian and Michael Wilmuth recorded in StoryCorps. I guess that's an example of people who maybe didn't need to be kicked out of the booth, but would have loved to stay there. You know,
yeah, you know, it's interesting. All these stories we're listening to are from Ties That Bind. And last year when I was touring around when it came out, at first in hardcover, you know, I met a lot of these people like the Wilmuths. And one of the things that tells me that what our production team is doing is right is that whenever you meet these folks, they're as amazing as they seem on the radio, but even better. Just kind of astounding people, all of the people in all this tape that you're hearing today.
Now that we do so much communication, you know, in written form, like via text and email, or else we rely on video, I think StoryCorps is a good reminder of how powerful the human voice is and how we just need to sort of learn to trust our ability to listen and to gain meaning simply from using the sense of hearing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think of StoryCorps as a project about listening much more, despite the name StoryCorps, it's much more about listening than about stories. It's a time where you turn off all of your devices and you just focus on another human being for 40 minutes and tell them how much they mean to you by asking, you know, the questions that we've been talking about. And I think that, you know, what we're doing here definitely is a bit, you know, against the grain. It's sort of, in some ways, I guess, the anti-Twitter or the anti-whatever that thing is where the pictures disappear after 10 seconds.
Snapchat,
Snapchat. So, you know, this is something permanent. It's meaningful. It's authentic communication. It's also, you know, it's really not about. We talk about this with staff a lot. You know, and in some ways, I feel like StoryCorps and like hospice work has some similarities. And I know that, you know, in folks who work in hospice, when they have team meetings, are often talking to each other about it's not about you. And that's kind of the theme of staff. Like, we're really here just to serve people, and it's not about us. And the people who are coming in the booth to do the interviews are it's this incredible act of generosity by listening to another person. So it's really kind of a focus in this kind of me, you know, time. It's a focus on someone else.
So I know that all of these are recorded permanently they will be made available to scholars who come along later. And I think of like the Lomaxes and the things that they recorded. Are you already hearing from scholars and social scientists, people who want to use these and listen to them and see what they might glean from them?
Yeah, I mean, it's now the largest collection of human voices ever gathered. So we'll have, you know, in the next week or two, 100,000th participant. But since it's two people in the booth, we're over 50,000. We're at 53 or 54,000 interviews. And they're at the Library of Congress. And I should say that, you know, when you come to StoryCorps, you can, at the end of the interview, you sign a release or you don't sign a release. And we don't care. I mean, if you're not comfortable with it going to the Library of Congress, you don't sign a release. We erase, you walk away with a CD. You've had a great experience. You can get a digital file and you can put it in a safe somewhere and share it with future generations. And one of the fascinating things about StoryCorps is that while I thought the compliance rate was going to be not high, because clearly what happens in the booth is so intimate, that about 99.9% or above of people who've participated in StoryCorps have signed that release. So everything has gone to the Library of Congress. And yes, scholars are in the material at the Library of Congress, everything from people looking at, you know, different kind of speech patterns in different parts of the country to, you know, finding very kind of specific groups of people in a very specific region who they want to do research on. So there's a lot of activity in the Library of Congress, and pretty soon we're going to work to make, in collaboration with the participants, to make the archive public on the web. And that'll be a couple years from now.
Do you guys spend a lot of time worrying about which format is going to last permanently? And do you save things in multiple formats?
That's, you know, the Library of Congress is very good. We have an archive department at StoryCorps. And the Library of Congress, you know, that's their job. And their job is to make sure that the format is correct and it's one that will – that they update the formats when need be. I mean, when StoryCorps started, we – you know, it was based on CDs. And, you know, things have changed as of I mean, maybe now, but within the next month or two, CDs won't be passed out in the booths anymore. People will get links to the digital files. Mm-hmm. So we have the best and the brightest kind of working on making sure that this will be accessible forever. And you know, again, part of the cool thing about it being at the library is that it's their job to make sure that that the stuff is updated and the technology is updated and the recordings are at the highest fidelity they can possibly be so that this can last, you know, 100, 200, 1,000 years.
So you're out there advocating for StoryCorps. You're overseeing it from the sort of 60,000-foot view, and I know that the fundraising challenges are endless.
Yes.
How often does somebody call you up or email you and say, Dave, you have to hear this one?
You know, not that often. you mean like you need this person to come to the booth?
No, I just mean like they have collected some sound and something is really astonishing and they say you
mean from my team or somebody
else?
From your team. Oh, I mean all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean I approve the broadcasts every week. So I'm, you know, and every week I'm astonished. Like that story we just heard of this guy who didn't realize he had a TBI, you know, a traumatic brain injury, and was, you know, was walking around with a gun pointed at his head, and somebody had to tell him. I didn't know, you know, when they played that for me last week, you don't know where that story is going to go. And I'm astounded every week by the stories. And I'm also astounded hearing from the facilitators. You know, if I've learned anything in the last 11 years, you know, I think that StoryCorps made me much more hopeful, you know, and the facilitators all come back and, you know, they serve. It's a very high burnout job. And yeah, I was actually in where you saw the tweets. I was at a conference in Chicago yesterday and there were a bunch of former facilitators there. And you know, one said that it's you know, you can go for a year or two. But once being in that booth, when you're not like amazed by what you're hearing anymore, mm-hmm. then it's time to go. It's made me much more hopeful. And what the facilitators say when they come back from the road is, you know, that people are basically good. And you could say that when we were at like 500 interviews or 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 or 10,000, that maybe it was, you know, there was a self-selection going on here. But now at this point, you know, there's a truth to this, and that's what we're hearing in these interviews day in and day out.
Let's listen now to Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel. In 1993, Israel was a teenager in Minneapolis. One night at a party, he got into a fight, which ended when he shot and killed Laramian Bird. Israel is now 34, has finished serving his prison sentence for second-degree murder. At StoryCorps, he spoke with Mary Johnson, who is the mother of the man he killed.
You and I met at Stillwater Prison. I wanted to know if you were in the same mindset of what I remember from court, where I wanted to go over and hurt you, but you were not that 16-year-old. You were a grown man. I shared with you about my son.
And he became human to me. You know, when I met you, it was like, okay, this guy is real. And then when it was time to go, you broke down and started shedding tears. And the initial thing to do was just try to hold you up as best I can. Just hug you like I would my own mother, you know.
After you left the room, I began to say, I just hugged the man that murdered my son. And I instantly knew that all that anger and the animosity, all the stuff I had in my heart for 12 years for you, I knew it was over. I treat you as I would treat my son. And our relationship is beyond belief. We live next door to one another.
Yeah, so you can see what I'm doing. You know, firsthand. Mm-hmm. We actually bump into each other all the time, leaving in and out of the house. And you know, our conversations, they come from, boy, how come you ain't called over here to check on me in a couple of days? You ain't even asked me if I need my garbage to go out.
Uh-huh.
I find those things funny because it's a relationship with a mother for real.
Wow.
That is Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel. You know, when I heard him say that he got to know Mary Johnson and then for the first time in his mind it clicked, oh, this guy is real. The man, young man I killed is real, was an actual person. It's very, very moving.
You know, there are other pieces of this interview. One of the things I love is when Mary says to O'Shea, you know, I know it's very difficult to be here and have this conversation. This is about 6 months after he had been released from the penitentiary. And she commends him on his courage for having the conversation. Of course, he thanks her for her courage. And then at the end of it, he says he thanks her. And she says, thank you, son. Now this is a very kind of unique story. But I think what it shows is a path that can be taken. And we get the response a lot from people that when they hear StoryCorps stories, they cry. And most StoryCorps stories aren't actually sad. But I think what happens is we're hearing something that's authentic. We're hearing people being generous with each other. And we're hearing, like in this case, regular people walking the highest possible path. And when you hear people living life to its fullest and deepest in this way, you're kind of walking on holy ground. And I think that's what causes this kind of Pavlovian immediate reaction when the music comes on of people starting to cry.
David Isay is my guest. He is founder of StoryCorps. The mobile booth will be at the AT&T Performing Arts Center starting November 20th to record in North Texas for a month. We'll come back to this conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
When I was in high school, I was taking algebra, and I was sitting at the kitchen table trying to do my homework. And I got frustrated and said, I just can't figure this out. So my father said, what's the problem? He came by. He said, what's the problem? And I said, that's just algebra. And he said, well, let me look at it. I said, Dad, they didn't even have algebra in your day. And I went to sleep. And around 4 o'clock that morning, he woke me up. He said, come on, son, get up. He set me at the kitchen table and he taught me algebra. What he had done is sit up all night and read the algebra book. And then he explained the problems to me so I could do them and understand them. And to this day, I live my life trying to be half the man my father was, just half the man. And I would be a success if my children loved me half as much as I love my father.
That is Lynn Weaver talking with his daughter Kimberly about his father, Ted Weaver, who worked as a janitor and chauffeur in Nashville, Tennessee. That piece was recorded by StoryCorps in Atlanta. We're speaking this hour with David Isay, the founder of StoryCorps. He's also author of a book now out in paperback called Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. The mobile booth will be coming to the AT&T Performing Arts Center starting November 20th and will record in North Texas for a month. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Maybe you have a favorite StoryCorps moment that you'd like to share and reminisce about. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Is it always evident, Dave, for the folks who are editing, the ones that do have that special something that would make them good candidates for broadcast, is that moment always clear to everyone in the room who's maybe listening to the raw audio?
I think so. The editors who work on the StoryCorps stories are very skilled. And you know, it's a process of over the course of a week figuring out what the right, you know, what should be in, what should be out. I was with the lead producer yesterday who talks about, you know, you cut it down small and then you kind of build it back up. I think so. And I should say, you know, on that last story, which is also in this in the paperback, is kind of a foundational StoryCorps story that speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about. That guy Ted Weaver, who Lynn Weaver was talking about, who worked as a janitor, as you said, in Knoxville, Tennessee. Lynn Weaver, when he recorded this, was chairman of surgery at the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. And came to honor his dad, who was the smartest, most decent person he'd ever met, and to meet Ted Weaver, who gave everything for his kid, who now, you know, whenever I ask him, Lynn Weaver, who's a very prominent surgeon, will travel anywhere in the country to talk about his dad with me anytime. And Ted Weaver is the kind of, you know, person we should be building statues to. He, you know, personifies the best of who we are. It's generosity and substance of character and intelligence and wisdom, dignity, dedication. He, Lynn tells the story in the book of his dad. He and his brother integrated a school in Knoxville, and they were the only two African Americans on a football team. And he tells a story about going to an away game. The team they were playing was all white. Everybody in the stands was white. They tackled someone and that person got hurt, and Lynn and his brother saw the crowds rise from the stands and start coming towards them. It was a football stadium. There were stands on one side and then a fence on the other side, and the two of them backed up, and all of the people in the stands were coming at them, and Lynn and his brother backed up and backed up and backed up to the fence. And then Lynn turned around and he saw his father on the other side of the fence. And he said to his brother, you know, dad's here, we're going to be safe. Mm-hmm. And they were. His dad, you know, got them out of it. So Ted Weaver is such a kind of personifies what StoryCorps is all about and the kind of stories that we tell.
I was spent the weekend with my 90-year-old father-in-law, and I was asking him about his experiences in World War II. And, yeah, you know, he would answer anything I asked him, but he's from a generation where you don't particularly get, you know, very emotional, even when you're telling the stories of your real life. And obviously that's not absolutely universal. But I wonder if you've noticed a sort of difference in terms of the way different generations communicate about the things that have mattered most to them in their lives.
A bit. I mean, I think that there's something about, and I hope that where is he?
He's in Houston.
Is he in Dallas?
Houston.
Can you bring him to the booth or?
He doesn't travel well these days. My husband and I have actually talked about it because he's got some great stories. He was 19 and he was the commander of this naval ship at that age.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things, it would be interesting, and maybe we can figure out how to do this, to bring StoryCorps, you know, to his house and do the interview. Because, you know, one thing that we find is that there's something about the formality of the process where people who normally wouldn't speak open up. I mean, I think as you were saying that, I was thinking about a story from the first 2 days of StoryCorps when a woman brought her husband in. He was a World War II vet. And they started talking and he talked about liberating Auschwitz and he started to cry in the interview and he really lost it. And the facilitator didn't quite know what to do. Should they stop the interview, he asked. And they said, no, let's finish. And then at the end of the interview, the facilitator said, how was that for you guys? And both of them said, great. And the wife said, you know, I've been married to this man for 60 years, and this is the first time I've ever seen him cry.
Wow.
And that kind of story we hear over and over again. So there's something the facilitators call it kind of the magic of the booth. Not everybody, but some people who would be less willing to open up, especially because they know that this will be preserved and it will become part of American history.
Hmm. So you mentioned that it's a high burnout job. Can you talk a little bit about the hard work that the facilitators do? They're not just standing there and making sure the door is closed and everything is positioned properly.
That's right. No, we get many, many, many applications for a facilitator position. And, you know, they're with people all day, as I said, bearing witness to these stories and these interviews. And a lot of them are very intense. I mean, we have, as I said, we have a project now with post 9/11, vets and their families. We've got everyone who lost a loved one on September 11th comes to StoryCorps to leave a record of their life. Even, the gay and lesbian stories, people coming in and talking about what it was like in the 50s or 40s even. To be gay and not to be able to talk about it, and the facilitators need to be it's not so different in some ways than your job, right? They have to be completely focused all day on another human being, two other human beings, and listening very, very, very intently. And I think it can really wear on people, especially because a lot of people talk about difficult things in the booth. But their job is to do everything from kind of greeting people to being in the booth when the conversation's happening. They keep a log of what's happening during the conversation for our archive. They help people. If people want the facilitators to ask questions, they'll ask questions. If they want the facilitators to be quiet, they'll be quiet. And they'll do the metadata entry at the end and, just basically walk people through this very, very intense experience. And I think it's intense for facilitators as well.
You come from a really creative family. And in fact, we've had your lovely mother on the show.
And
I wonder if it's any easier for you to have conversations like these with people you care about than it is for everybody else.
I don't think so. I mean, I come from a, my mom is great. I had, part of the story of how StoryCorps came to be is that when I was in my 20s, I found out that my dad was gay. And it was a big surprise for me. And actually there were a lot of secrets and kind of stuff not being said in my family. And I ended up when I was a kid, when I found this out, I was 22 years old. I had just gotten into radio and I used my microphone to learn about a world I didn't know anything about and did an oral history of the Stonewall riots, which started the was the modern LGBT movement. And, it was mostly transgender, transvestite kids. Mm-hmm. who fought against the police when they were being evicted from a bar finally after all these years, and met some of the most courageous, amazing people I'd ever met. And again, used the microphone to learn about who my dad was, and it changed my relationship with my dad completely, who died a few years ago, actually on the anniversary of Stonewall. And this year we launched our LGBT thing on Stonewall in his memory. That's on June 28th. But, I did an interview with my dad, and you wouldn't find it interesting. Most people wouldn't find it interesting, but I'm an old dad. I have two little kids. The night he died, it was the first time I ever listened to it at 3 a.m.
Hmm.
And, that's when the rubber really hit the road for me, because I was listening to this person who was, along with my mom, one of the most important people in my life, and realizing this was the only way my two kids were going to get to know him and the importance of the fact that we had done this interview. So, I came from a complicated family. Everybody does. There were a lot of psychiatrists in my family. So I guess listening was part of it. And my mom, who you met, was an editor for many years. Everybody, part of the lesson of StoryCorps is that everybody is capable of doing this. Again, 55,000 interviews with, people who are sitting in the seat doing the interviews. One of the you know, fallacies that I had as a documentary maker, one of the things that I was concerned about when we started StoryCorps was that I had been doing radio documentaries for all these years, and I thought, you know, I had to be in the room for something interesting to happen. Right. And that was completely wrong. It had absolutely nothing to do with me. You know, anybody is capable of this. People are capable of listening, of asking these questions. And the impact that it can have on people to be asked, you know, is just remarkable, especially people who might feel like they don't deserve to be remembered or to be asked these kind of stories. So the people who are kind of farthest out of, in some ways, people who are farthest from kind of the mainstream, the act of participating in StoryCorps can be particularly transformative for them.
How did you come up with 40 minutes as being the sort of sweet spot length for those interviews?
It was just a guess. We run on an hour schedule. And so it's, you know, 10 minutes to prepare, 40 minutes in the booth, 10 minutes to kind of cool down after the interview, and then the next pair comes in. So there are always two facilitators at least at a booth. And it worked. So we didn't mess with it. You know, there were a bunch of guesses when we started StoryCorps. One was that we needed facilitators to have this full StoryCorps experience, which absolutely proved to be true. Another was that we needed this, you know, sacred space of this booth, which turned out not to be true. I mean, like I said, we could bring a facilitator to your grandfather's house, and you would have, as long as it's quiet and the TVs are off, you know, and you're in a place where there aren't distractions, you can have an equally good experience. So it was a bunch of guesses based on my having done, you know, documentaries for a long time for public radio, and most of them proved to be right, and we just kind of haven't messed with the stuff that's correct.
You mentioned that you have two young children. I would imagine this line of work has affected the kinds of things you know you want to say to them, but do you have to think about the right timing?
Well, they're very young. So, I mean, StoryCorps completely changed my life in so many ways. And I retired from making radio documentaries a few months into StoryCorps when I saw the potential of this thing. And I don't think we've begun to tap the potential of StoryCorps. But so many of the decisions I make, so many of the things I say and how I live my life come from the lessons that we're culling from regular people. So, you know, I think of there's a 9/11 interview we did where there's an animation of it also of a guy who lost his two sons. One was a cop and one was a firefighter on September 11th. And he talks about their lives, incredible young men. And he says that every day he would say to these kids, always, as a rule, I love you. And they'd always say, I love you back. And you know, he said that it gives him peace to know that the last words he said and the last words that he heard from his kids were, I love you. You could bet that the last thing I say to my kids every day is I love you. You know, I think the message of StoryCorps is just how, you know, look, life is fragile. And you never know what's going to happen. And, you know, it sounds kind of corny, but I mean, you know, you want to try to live the days as fully as you possibly can. And you want to tell the people who mean something to you how much they mean to you. I mean, I think that StoryCorps and hospice have some similarities. And there's this saying that in hospice, I was saying before a little bit about this, where there are four things you want to say to someone before they die. And this is when someone's actively dying. And that's thank you, I love you, forgive me, I forgive you. And then finally, the fifth is goodbye. Mm. And in some ways, I think what the StoryCorps booth does is gives us the opportunity to have that conversation with someone now. And even though hopefully, you know, we're not actively dying when we're in the booth, we're all dying. I mean, we're never going to find a cure for that. And to have those conversations and tell people who mean something to us how much they mean to us today and not to waste time.
David Isay is founder of StoryCorps. The StoryCorps mobile booth will be parked at the AT&T Performing Arts Center starting November 20th. Reservations to participate are currently full, but you can find waitlist information at StoryCorps.org. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on again. It's great to talk to you. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.